Blog Talk Radio.
Bringing you excellent entertainment from the king of DC media, here's the Inside Acting Radio Show.
And now, here's your host, William Powell, the king of DC media.
Good evening, everyone. It is I, the king of DC media, William Powell, your host, internationally known, nationally respected, and locally appreciated. Welcome to the Inside Acting Radio Show. Tonight's guest is Paul Curiazzi, the author of the James Bond Lifestyle Seminar and the director of such films as Omega Cop, Weapons of Death, and Ninja Busters, which is being released on Blu-ray later this month. Before we get to Paul, let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Hey, federal employees, what would you do with $1 million? Your wishful thinking can become a reality. We're FedChoice, and we're here to help you achieve your million-dollar dreams, from saving you money on a loan to helping you save for retirement. Visit us online at FedChoice.org and use the keyword inside. FedChoice Federal Credit Union, an official sponsor of the Inside Acting Radio Show. FedChoice Federal Credit Union, federally insured by NCUA.
All right, and if you would like to advertise on this show, email me at william400@yahoo.com. So before we bring Paul on, let me read an excerpt from the James Bond Lifestyle Seminar. I'm happy, I'm broke, I'm sick, I'm tired, I'm a mess, I'm prosperous. Can you find the two most powerful words among these? They're the words I am. These two words will program the mind more than any others. And what you put after them will become your life. I am. Just fill in the blank, and your mind will start guiding you to that state of being, whether it's positive or negative. It will just follow your orders. All right, so I see Paul is on the line, so let me bring him on in. Konnichiwa, Paul. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you, William, and I am very happy to be connected with you. I'm calling in from Japan, you only live twice line, land, I should say, only live twice land. I'm on the line, and it's 11:30 in the afternoon here. 11:30 in the
Amazing.
Morning, I should say. Yeah, we're time traveling.
That's right,
I'm one day ahead of you. I'm in your future, and I'm here to tell you your future tomorrow is going to be great.
Fantastic. So, yeah, man, so what's new?
You know, it's interesting. Mentioned in my James Bond Lifestyle that I had read this Hollywood agent. I read his whole book. And what impressed me, he says if an actor can have three new things going within 6 weeks, like he's got a new movie that's a hit, he's got his new book, autobiography, and he's on a, you know, he gets an interview on Johnny Carson or Jay Leno show. If he gets three things in a short period of time, he is perceived as being hot, moving up. Now, that's hard to do. You know, it's hard enough to get one good thing going, but to get three within 6 weeks or 2 months is difficult. But I think the first time in my life I got three things within 6 weeks, since you asked me what's up, I have the new edition of How to Live the James Bond Lifestyle called the Spectre Edition. Just came out now on Amazon. And as you know, about 20 days, the Spectre James Bond movie will be out. Now, that's not mine, of course. So I got the Spectre Edition. I also have the Japanese version release, and that's a whole new market over here. And my old movie, Ninja Busters, was found in the Mojave Desert. I'll tell you that story. So they're making a Blu-ray out of that. So that's three things within 6 weeks. So let's see if my image and my entertainment business moves up a notch.
All right. So I want to dive into Ninja Busters. Now, it was made back in 1984, or it came out in 84. I think you started filming it in 1980. And it somehow this guy went to a vault somewhere in Mojave Desert. So tell that story. How was it rediscovered?
Well, yeah, it is a wild story, and you are correct. That was my fourth film that I rewrote and then directed in 19, started in 1980. We ran out of money, and I made that with the actors that were in Death Machines, as well as my third movie, Weapons of Death, Eric Lee, Sid Campbell, and in Oakland, California, around the his karate studio in Oakland. So it's a comedy movie about two guys, naive guys that join a karate school to pick up girls, and then that's the first 45 minutes of the movie. In the last half, they get involved with gangsters and ninjas. So it's a pretty fast. It's a fast, funny movie. We showed it to an audience of about 800, and they just screamed and laughed. We gave it to a distributor. Unfortunately, it's the wrong distributor. You know how that story goes in the 80s. People would give their films to distributors and not get anything back for it. But this distributor, I don't know if he made another print, but we gave him the one print. And, long story short, he went to prison for 6 years for stealing money from all his movies, including Ninja Busters. Wasn't heard of. The print disappeared. So now, 30 years later, a year ago, this film collector named Harry Guerrero heard that there was all these prints in a storeroom in the Mojave Desert, old movies. So he went there, and he called it a hellhole. And I looked up, rattlesnakes love those kind of storerooms with dust and spiders. And the Mojave Desert has the most deadly rattlesnakes. They have two different types of venom inside them. So he risked going into that storeroom, pulling. And some of these prints were, the print themselves had turned to rust and was so strong acid it ate through the metal cans. But Ninja Busters was okay, the print. He loaded up the prints and drove across America in ice storm to New Jersey and showed Ninja Busters at a film festival, 3-day film festival. Turned out it was the hit of the festival. Everybody loved it. I got emails from people that found me and said it was hilarious. They were laughing so hard, they were crying. And it was such a big hit, and it was an exploitation film festival, and it was even more popular, they said, than Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13. And people said likable characters, fast action, and hilarious. So because of that, this guy Harry, film collector, is making it into Blu-ray. He's also taking my first movie. It was a black and white movie about three samurai coming to England to join a fencing tournament. Kind of all takes place in the woods, but I couldn't sell it. But he's putting my first movie on as a bonus. So I got two lost movies that are coming out on Blu-ray the end of this month. So that's the story of Ninja Busters. And, if you persevere in the business as an actor or, crew member, director, writer, bonus things happen. And that one just came out of the blue. My movie Omega Cop, just 3 months ago, played in a theatrical theater in Oregon for a bingo night, and they advertised it. And 2 years ago, my second movie, Death Machines, was brought out, not Blu-ray, but regular video, first-time widescreen off a 35-millimeter print with my commentary on it. So, if you persevere, you keep your shingle out there, you might have a side job or whatever, but I encourage people to keep going, and these bonus things happen.
Yeah, now you mentioned Death Machines, you did the commentary. I've always wondered, how do they set that up? You just go to a studio, do you do it on your smartphone or turn it in? How do you do that?
You know, that's a good question. I watch lots of commentary. And yeah. I always wondered, and sometimes the actors are together, sometimes they're not. The Death Machines I did by Skype, and I had the technician in America. We both started our copies of Death Machines at the same time, and I recorded as I watched it. And anybody making commentary, there's great commentaries, and then there's some so-so where people just wing it. In fact, people are complaining about the new commentary that The Exorcist director did for Vertigo. You know, it was just like, it was unbelievably, it was like, okay, there's Kim Novak, she's at the door, okay, she's, the door opens, she's walking across the room, he's just telling what's happening. It got bad, and I thought, is it just me? But people on the internet were complaining. That was William Friedkin that did that. So what I do on commentary, I make notes. I might have about 50 notes on paper of things that I do want to talk about, but also people want scene-specific commentary where you point things out and say, look at that, and look at that. So while I'm doing scene-specific, I'll also do my notes, and when I finish something on a note, I'll check it off, and then I'll go back to, you know, scene, talking about scene specific. Now, this man, Harry Guerrero Corrector, I said I'd do it by Skype, and he said, no, no, we need better quality, get the Zoom microphone. So I got that Zoom high-quality microphone. I watched it, of course, with the sound off, and recorded it holding the Zoom recorder. I did first take, I was pretty good, and the second take was great. It was so great I could never do it that good again. So then I emailed him the file, and then he did all the technical work of putting it together. So those are the two ways. It seems like some of them do go to a studio, and like when they gathered where they gather a couple of people together, they'll go to a screening room or a studio.
Right, right. Now, you got to talk about the newest edition of the James Bond Lifestyle Seminar. What's some of the things you added to it?
Yeah, I added about 40, I think about 50 pages of new material, and also adding in the actual material, and then I have these 2015 notes. When I did the 2012 edition, I had 2012 notes, and they're bold, and now I got the 2015, and just a lot more updated information. And I'll tell you, this Uber car service that you have on your telephone, I'm sure everybody's familiar with that. It's just one of the great things for the James Bond lifestyle for guys living the James Bond convenience. You know, you call people on the, you know, you call them on the phone, and you see the phone knows where you're at, and it's all done by credit card that you have on the company's site. And you know, I take a lot of taxis, I do a lot of car rental, but I'm always having to, you know, make sure I have cash, a lot of 20s and 10s and 5s and
right,
you know, for taxis. And this way, it's just incredible. You just call them. So I give some inside Uber information. It's interesting. I'm going to be going to America. I usually rent a car with my I carry all the insurance, and I have a higher level car. So it's about $150 a day. But I'm going to Palm Springs from L.A. and don't need a car there. Visiting somebody, so I checked on Uber. You can go online too and check estimate prices. They only go, a lot of people don't know this, they only go 100 miles. And Palm Springs is 106 miles from Los Angeles. And
wow.
It won't take, so what I do, here's a little trick that what I'm going to do is take an Uber car to San Bernardino halfway, and I check from San Bernardino. They do have indeed have cars that are, you know, 5 minutes away and ready to take me to Palm Springs. So I'll use the two Uber car system to overcome that that 100-mile limit. And I make sure that I looked up, I don't know San Bernardino that well, but I made sure I got the dropped off at the very best shopping mall. So in case there's any delay, I got food, restrooms, movie theaters, whatever. And I don't want to be dropped off in the middle of the desert, you know. So there's a little trick. There's a little trick. So I have material like that. I added more photos that are empowering, and you know, especially with the money section. So those are some of the things that I have. And I have Spectre quotes that I got from the previews of Spectre, and I use those because I have quotes all through anytime it relates to the subject, just not random quotes, but if it relates to the subject I'm talking about, then I'll quote James Bond or one of the villains or whatever. So, yeah, I'm very excited about it. So
that's great. That's great. Yeah, you taking mental possession of Uber cars and shopping centers and everything.
Yeah, you know, that's it, William. That's one of the big things about the James Bond lifestyle. You hit the nail on the head there. I learned from my success teacher years ago to take mental possession of hotels as your second homes. And it's a very powerful thing to do. If you have a second or third home, that's great. If you actually own it, you know, ownership is great, but there's also responsibility with ownership. And of course, great expense. But, you know, I would go up to Lake Tahoe, Caesar's Palace twice a year. And that was my hotel. And, I took mental possession and I didn't have to worry if, you know, the window was cracked or, you know, I didn't have to bring cleaning products and towels in. Everything was there waiting for me. So that,
right.
take mental possession, rental boats. If you're not going to use a boat, you know, every week, you might as well rent a boat, and you have less expense and responsibility. That's a good point you brought up.
Exactly. So now what do you think James Bond creator Ian Fleming would say about the James Bond Lifestyle Seminar?
Well, since Ian Fleming did live in the Bahamas, and he lived a great lifestyle, and I think he wanted to be James Bond, because in the first book, he describes James Bond as looking like the piano player Hoagy Carmichael. Now, your listeners may not know who that is. He was the piano player in the movie Best Years of Our Lives. But he's kind of a thin kind of guy, kind of a Fred Astaire kind of looking guy, and that's what Ian Fleming looked like as well. So Ian Fleming looked like Hoagy Carmichael, and he said James Bond looked like Hoagy Carmichael. So I think he saw himself as James Bond. He certainly lived a prosperous and luxury lifestyle. So I think he would be very positive about my James Bond lifestyle course, because I don't talk about you know, weapons or drinking or smoking. I talk about lifestyle. So I think he'd approve and be excited about it.
Yeah. I'll segue into the next question is, well, what do you think he would say about Spectre, the new movie coming out?
Oh, you know, I think he only saw one or two movies, which is too bad, just Dr. No and From Russia with Love. I don't think he saw Goldfinger. So he would be amazed, I think, at the technology of the new Bond movies. And I'll tell you, I have not purposely not looked at the trailer of Spectre. I got the trailer quotes just off the internet. Somebody listed all the quotes from the trailer. I was very happy that I did not look at the trailer for Terminator Genesis, because I just wanted to watch it fresh. And then I found out fans were angry. They told two big spoilers of the story in the trailer. I mean, some fans were angry. Well, I didn't look at the trailer until after I saw the movie, and I thought, oh, my God, what are they doing? And they thought, well, the producers are hedging their bets. They're saying, come to the movie. We've got this, you know, spin on the story, and we got this spin on the story. But they blew the surprise. So I was very smart you know, not to spoil it for myself. So I'm doing the same thing with the Spectre movie. I have not seen the trailer at all. So I have an open mind and ready for any surprises they might throw at us.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting that you say that, because, like, you look at other franchises like Star Wars, and one of the appeals of Star Wars, at least back in the 70s, is, like, you knew very little about it. There was no YouTube or anything. There was, like, word of mouth, and it seemed like it just built up a lot of anticipation.
Yeah, exactly. often the trailers just show too much. They got more so, you know, you're right, in the, from Star Wars on, you know, you're right, they didn't show much of Star Wars, but I guess it was from Jaws was 1975 and Star Wars. After that, producers started hedging their bets with longer trailers and showing more. But what they did with the Terminator Genesis was ridiculous.
Mm. Yeah. So why do you think so many Hollywood action movies, it seems like some of them are boring? I mean, they just have too much action. Why do you think that is?
Boy, well, you hit it right there. Too much action. And it's always the last scene. It's just repetitive action that goes on too long without furthering the plot or furthering the character. So, yeah, that's it. And, of course, a lot of the action movies rely on the action and don't have as much character and plot to reveal. A really great example would be the original Die Hard movie that revealed character. Of course, that was written by the great screenwriter Shane Black, who did Sea of Love, and he got a lot of character in there, a lot of great lines, the man-woman relationship, to the point where the woman had left, John McClane's wife had left him. She was living in California. She was working for this Japanese company, and they gave her a Rolex watch as a bonus. And at the very end of the movie, if you remember, she's hanging off the edge of the building, and the bad man is hanging onto her wrists, and John McClane takes off her Rolex so the bad man would fall. So she, by taking off the Rolex, of course, the action happened, but it was also symbolic of she's coming back to him and leaving the company. And so then at the end, she introduces, at the end, yeah, isn't that clever? At the end, she introduces herself, you know, as she said her name, she was using her maiden name, and then she says, you know, no, I'm Holly McClane. So she went back to her. And so they had the whole man-woman relationship in there. They had an interesting villain, so many surprises. But some, you know, some producers think, oh, it's the action that sold it. You know, but it was... it was the action with, you know, with the character and the great lines, as you, I'm sure you remember, that was in that. So you have to, you know, compare a lot of movies to that original Die Hard or Aliens by Jim Cameron. So you got to move that plot forward. You got to have interesting, interesting characters. And so many times, I remember Antonio Banderas in the movie Zorro, which was terrific, but that last fight in the mines just went on forever, just didn't stop. And they had a great ending, the explosion, and he comes walking out of the dust carrying the child, and everybody was behind him. The good guys survived, but all that sword fighting, and it just went on forever. So you hit it, just too much action. You know, what I like is the director Howard Hawks, who did Rio Bravo and The Thing, he said he liked his action where it explodes and bang, and it's like, what happened? You know, he didn't use slow motion. And Quentin Tarantino did that in the movie Inglourious Basterds, in the cellar bar scene, where they built up suspense for 20 minutes, and then the guns came out, and ba-da-ba-boom-boom, boom, and it's over in 5 seconds. You go, wow, what happened? That's very Howard Hawks, and Quentin Tarantino is a fan of Howard Hawks. So, you know, I wish more directors would use that. Of course, you have to have longer action scenes, you know, to be an action movie. You just can't have, the Howard Hawks style, but it's great to have, you know, one or two of those scenes of fast action.
Yeah, that's spaghetti westerns. It's one of the things I love about those films too. It's just like the tension is like just drives you crazy, and it's like this very quick gunfight. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that brings to mind the end of The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, where the three people you know, Clint Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef and Eli Wallach, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. They're doing that three-man showdown. That went on for 6 minutes before they drew their guns, with that great music and close-ups and the hands moving to the, you know, to the holsters. And yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Absolutely. So let's change gears a little bit and talk about what do you think about Hollywood's system of giving parts and salaries to stars? I mean, do you think that Hollywood is fair to actors and crew members?
Well, it's interesting. There was an email leaked just a couple of days ago, and it's talking about Jennifer Lawrence getting less, 2% less percentage points she on that one movie she did with Bradley Cooper.
And
that just leaked, and she got 7 points, and even though she's Academy Award winner, and the men got 9 points, so she got only, you know, she got $10 million, and she could have got $12 million. It reminds me also about in the 80s, Sally Field was talking about, even though she had an Academy Award and was hot, she got $10 million, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, who never won an Academy Award, got $20 million, so she was kind of protesting male actors get more. But I tell you, William, I've read where the Hollywood business has not changed since the silent era. Lillian Gish was the first giant star, a woman. She made more money than anybody. Hollywood, it's a business, and it seems to be very fair, because it's tough, but I think fair, because it's always been whoever sells, you know, the most tickets can have their agent negotiating higher prices. And, you know, Sally Field made those great movies and was popular, but was not world popular, didn't sell as many tickets as Arnold Schwarzenegger. And, you know, action movies has been the staple since, the first silent movies. One of the first silent movies was called Duel with Sledgehammers.
Really?
I saw the post. Yeah, can you imagine that? Duel with Sledgehammers. I saw the poster of that, but I guess the print disappeared. But it's always been action movies, the great train robbery. And action movies usually have men. And then it changed with Sigourney Weaver and Aliens, which is great to have these great female action characters. But whoever sells the most tickets can negotiate the higher salaries. So whether it's men or women or ethnic actors, I think it's just fair if you can sell more tickets. You know, I swear this happened. Last night I was watching an old YouTube video of Howard Stern, a couple of years old, where Andy Dick had, the comedian Andy Dick had got fired off his show, and then Andy Dick got in all kinds of trouble. And he did an interview, Andy Dick did an interview, calling Howard Stern bad names. And so Howard Stern rants on it. And for you listeners, you can check the title, the YouTube title, Howard Stern TV Interview on Andy Dick. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he just does a tirade of, you know, Howard Stern's net worth is $500 million, and he was, you know, Andy Dick was complaining he's got talent and doesn't have his own show, and Howard Stern says, man, I was working hard, and I started off in these small radio stations, and he says all I did was listen to other shows and listen to radio, study radio, and had to compete. And he competed by creating, which is what I talk about in the James Bond lifestyle. You have to change from the competitive mind to the creative mind. And he created this great show. So he goes onto this whole tirade. And the reason I'm saying this, he says, you go, talking to Andy Dick, you go to a small radio station and you get fans and you get listeners and you get sponsors and you build up, you know, the the fans, and
once
again, that's selling. You know, it's all sick. You can be in the car business. Whoever sells the most cars is going to rise up in the company. So I think, to answer your question about the salaries, men versus women actors, it's all who can sell the most tickets. So
absolutely.
I think it's a tough business, but I think it's fair. You know, if you can, if a movie you make goes out and sells a lot, you're gonna move up as an actor or a director. Or if you shoot, the cameraman shoots, you know, great footage and people see it, he'll be hired. So it's a tough business, but I think it's fair. And like Howard Stern says, I really recommend that people listen to that. There's a lot of swearing in it, so don't have children around. He really goes on a tirade, but it's work your butt off, you know, and build your audience.
Absolutely. That sounds very Brian Tracy-esque. I mean, Brian Tracy kind of talks about that a lot, too. That's basically a sort of a bottom line kind of thing. And like everybody out there, you're really your own boss, really. And, you know, whether you have an employee or you're self-employed, you're really the person that's out there selling. You know, it's all about selling.
Yeah. You know, we're on radio, and when I was a boy, Casey Kasem was in San Francisco, and he was called Casey at the Mic. He was just in the San Francisco radio station, and he had the little girl without a name, and then we'd push a button, uh-huh, honey, which was Brenda Lee from a song, and then he had another guest called Crazy, you catch on fast, and he did all these funny voices, and he was really entertaining. But he said he finally had to drop that, and when he started to do these history of music, and he would say this next singer, and he wouldn't say the name, did this and this and this, and he's telling what the singer did and his history, and you're wondering, who is it? And then at the end he'd say, it's Frankie Avalon, and here's Venus. So he'd have this suspense, and he says when he started getting the history and the back history of all these singers and introducing the records that way, that's when he took off. And eventually he moved to a New York radio station, national, and he was getting $20 million a year. And Casey Kasem, I'll never forget, he said, I learned what every hole in that microphone did. Now, of course, you can't learn. He was just using that as an analogy, but he's meaning he learned everything about radio that he could. And that's what Howard Stern was saying. He says, I studied everything about radio. So, you know, there's another example. So I saw Casey Kasem go from a local show with funny voices to this history of rock and roll radio and then on to television with his history of rock and roll.
That's right. So I got a question here from fan Troy Sweezy. Okay, he writes, in this day and age, is it possible to have a super successful movie like Robert Rodriguez's El Mariachi, which cost $7,000, or Kevin Smith's Clerks, which cost $600,000, or the movies have to have a $150 million budget like Casino Royale?
Well, yeah, that's very interesting that Robert Rodriguez made his movie on credit cards, and I read about that. He had a good story, and his timing into the business was on his side, and he had a hit with that. Spike Lee did that with his first movie that was done in black and white.
Yeah.
She's Gotta Have It.
Yeah,
and it was unique and very low budget. So same thing with the first found footage movie, the Blair Witch Project. They lucked out. You know, they had all that handheld, but they lucked out with a story and went on the internet. So it's great to have a big budget, with stars and all these locations. I mean, that's part of the movies, you know, stars and locations and action and surprises and stereo sound. But if you can have a good story, you could sneak in there. My second movie, Death Machines, was a $70,000 budget. We filmed in Technoscope, which The Good, Bad, and the Ugly also did, which is half frame, shoots half frame, but cuts that half frame into a Panavision shape frame, and then the prints are made as Panavision, so you get a Panavision look. And Technoscope sounds so cool, like Technorama. The audiences don't know it's really half frame 35, so it's a very economical. But Crown International picked the movie up, and you know, I had very exploitable ideas in there, and cops and gangsters and bar fights and karate. I'd had everything in there. Blew up a Piper Club airplane for real, and even on that budget, we had a real one that flew, and then we had another real one, but that was gutted, that we blew up. We bought for $2,000, and which that sold Crown International. They put that movie out in 50 movie theaters in Los Angeles alone, including the Egyptian theater where they premiered Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments, that famous classic theaters. 50 theaters alone in L.A., quarter-page ads. So I just lucked out. And they moved it across America. Just before Jaws came out, where they started that. That came out with 800 theaters at once. That was the first one to do that. And then after that, now I think they go to 3,000 theaters at once. So my point is $70,000, and I lucked out with Crown International really getting behind it and promote it. New York, they had semi-color ads in the newspaper, quarter page, and it played in Times Square. And the three killers we had, one was Caucasian, one was Afro-American, because those movies, Afro-American movies, were big at that time, and one was Asian, and they had big framed photos of each of the three killers out in front of the theater, and they were unknowns. So yes, if you get lucky, you can hit a home run. That's just like anything. You buy real estate, and if you're lucky, you hit a home run, and your real estate goes up 10 times. The same thing can happen with a movie on a lower budget. Blair Witch Project is a good example of that. Speaking of that, because I'm in Japan, there's a giant theater in this entertainment area, 1,100 seats, and they had the Blair Witch Project playing there. And like the third day, I went past the theater, and they had a new sign out there in English and in Japanese saying, if you don't like shaky camera work, if it makes you dizzy, don't see this movie. So evidently they had so many people complaining about the shaky camera that they had to warn people. So that's a little side movie note I wanted to throw in. So.
Yeah. Okay, Paul, we're coming up on, I'm giving you a very early warning, about 19 minutes. There's so much I want to get to. So I want to jump quickly into another question we have from Mr. Sweezy about, speaking of found footage, and we were just talking about that, would you ever make a found footage film?
You know, I don't have the talent for that. My genre is thrillers, you know, like romantic thrillers. I've been doing that with audiobooks, or action with hopefully great plots and characters. I just don't have the vision for that. Blair Witch Project was scary, you know, scary. Wasn't totally satisfying for me as a found footage. But there was the movie Cloverfield, which was found footage, very clever. That was the one with the big Godzilla monster in New York, and they had a party, and those four teenagers were trying to get out of town, if you remember that. I saw that in the theater. That was fantastic. Saw that a couple times. And then another movie, Chronicle, where three boys go into some kind of pit, and there was a meteor, and it gave them this psychic power, and they could fly. And, man, that one was fantastic. As well. So I do like found footage movies, especially Cloverfield and Chronicle. But you have to be careful with those. That's a very tricky genre, and I just don't have the enlightenment for that. I don't know where I would start. And it's been done so much, I'm surprised there's so many.
Yeah.
And there's there's a new one coming out. I can't remember the name, but that's a genre in itself, isn't it?
No,
so now
absolutely.
To you know, Alfred Hitchcock always repeated. He says, "I'm always trying to avoid the cliche." So now found footage is cliche. What would you do to be original when the Blair Witch Project was the originator of found footage? So no, I wouldn't know where to start. Now, if a project was given to me with the script that a producer stood behind and thought would work, then of course I could execute it technically, and I think I could come up with some ideas. And number one, not having jerky camera work. which Cloverfield did not have much of, nor did Chronicle.
So let's talk about your audiobook, The Mexican Swimmer. How did that do?
Oh, well, there's a story of perseverance. I wrote that a year ago. It was the greatest creative experience. I started it off as a short story. I had it on my writer's site. People said, "Man, this would make the greatest series." It's sort of a kind of a book noir dark story, like what's the Robert Rodriguez movies, Part One and Part Two. Anyway, it's a dark
what's
film
the
noir.
What's
the Sin City.
Oh, Sin
it's
City.
A Sin City
yeah, yeah.
type of thing. And I wrote it in the first person. And present tense, and that was so good. I did a part two, so I got two novellas, 100 page each, and I recorded it as an audio book with one person. I hired a Mexican American actor that I used in my other audio books, named Julian Scott Urena, very talented, great voice, and we did it first person. And he did voices, he did women's voices that were not falsetto voices, but you just felt like it. It just felt like a full cast. Then I added sound effects, music, total production. And while I was doing it, you know, I just thought this is going to be really selling. And that's what all producers, you know, feel like. You know, when you don't start a movie or even a book unless you think it'll be read with an audience. And I thought, I checked, Kindle is very popular in Mexico, and so when I got the project done, I put it on, and here's I think I invented this. Instead of going to Audible or another distributor, my style is have the Kindle written version book, and in there is a link, free link to download the audio. So for $3.95, they get a Kindle book of the story, and then a link of the full cast audio, which is 3 hours. I thought, what a deal. And
nice.
I did Facebook ads. Now, here's the thing. It's the dream. We all start off with a dream, and the dream empowers us, and sometimes we think this is going to be great, and some movies go, and some don't. And it's the dream. It's just an exciting year, and I was watching The Making of Psycho. I thought, this is going to be a big escape seller like Psycho, and a big surprise, and especially in Mexico. And it, like I said, you know, I did the research, and so when I got it done, you know, the audio is terrific. So I put it on Amazon, and with the free link to the audio, and I did Facebook ads to Mexican men in Mexico who have Kindles, and you know, who like you know, noir books, or you know, that kind of fiction. And I directed the ads to them, and 200 people of them clicked to check it out on Amazon, and zero bought it. You know, and I wasn't disappointed. But it's like, well, you know, I understand that, you know, it's just some things don't work out. And, you know, for your listeners, you know, you got actors and film people. I was watching this movie called Public Eye. Joe Pesci is a 1940s cameraman in New York. He takes news pictures, and he sells a newspaper, and he's also got his book he's trying to get published, a special news photos, and he can't get a publisher interested. And Barbara Hershey, plays a part, and she says, you know, I tried to be an artist, a ballerina, but I gave up. And she says to Joe Pesci, you're the real thing. You're a real artist. And Pesci says, why do you say that? She says, because you would have given up a long time ago. And in that movie, Joe Pesci's like 40. And when I saw that movie, I was 40. And it was like Barbara Hershey was telling me, Paul, you're the real thing because you haven't given up. So, you know, actors are artists and you know, directors and writers and crew members. It's all part of the artistic group. And to have that dream, and when you have disappointments or projects that fail, and to keep going, you're the real thing. You know, we take side jobs or we expand. You know, what changed me, I went from not only feature film directing, I expanded my mind to books and audio productions, and you know, I got to direct my favorite actors in those audio books, 19 of them. And if we continue with the dream, we are the real thing. So Barbara Hershey was talking to me and Joe Pesci as well. So that's a good movie, The Public Eye. A lot of people don't know that movie, but it's for to continue as a freelance and to finally get success or a lucky break. So now The Mexican Swimmer is still a great, you know, project, and I have the audio, and it recorded it. I think it was with just one actor, it was going to be $5,000, but I went up. He was having trouble with the voices, but what he was doing, the actor was so good. So we went into, you know, double the time I thought to record at a professional studio. So that the budget at $6,000, I think, went up to $12,000. But it stands. I've got it, and I've got it on CD. I've got it, and it might be discovered as I move up, like with this James Bond lifestyle, and then people check out my other audios. You know, I've got it. It's completed, and there's no more money drained because it's produced and finished. So, yeah, it technically failed. But with the internet now, a movie can be discovered. A book can be discovered. Audio can be discovered. So I encourage your listeners to, you know, even though we all have different jobs to sustain ourselves, to keep that dream going and keep, you know, pursuing on different levels the acting and the writing and directing. The acting could be done at local theaters and local playhouses. They can produce their own video these days with digital and produce their own short films that where they can perform in or they direct. So, keep that dream going. And it was The Mexican Swimmer. Yeah, it didn't sell right away. Now, some people did buy it. And they left great reviews. The ones that did buy it left great reviews on Amazon. So as those reviews build, and you know, get a couple of buyers of that one every month, and some reviews, so it could still take off because it's still great, and I still have that dream for it. Yeah. So to be the real thing, it's perseverance, and. As I say in the James Bond lifestyle, is you know, perseverance is the number one aspect of success. More important than talent, more important than intelligence, and more important than education. Those three things are important, but without perseverance, if you give up, the dream stops.
Well, like Churchill said, never, never, never give up. We're coming up about, I guess, 8.5 minutes. So you have a wild John Carradine story. Do tell.
Yeah. I was making Omega Cop, and one of the, at that time, John Carradine, famous actor, and I'll tell you some of his credits in a minute, he had died, and some crew member said, yeah, I read John Carradine died, and I read in the newspaper, and the guy says, yeah, he made 160 movies, most of them bad. Ah, ha, ha. Man, I was, like, really bugged because I'm a fan of Carradine. You know, most film fans, you know him from either the classic movies or the horror movies that he made. I was really bugged, and I wanted to tell this guy, but we're in the middle of the – I kept my mouth shut. Over the years, I would see – you know, re-see movies, The Ten Commandments. There's John Carradine. Oh, my God, I wish I could go on a this guy's name was, I'll use the fictitious name Fred. I wish I could go in a time machine and go back there and tell Fred, what are you talking about? He's in Ten Commandments, and I'd see all these movies, and I'd build this list of my in my mind John Carradine movies, but I couldn't go in a time machine. So there I am at Spy Fest on the Queen Mary at this VIP party. There's only about 12 of us, and who walks in the door? David Carradine. And I walk over to David, and I said, after in the party, he was kind of by himself, and I said, David, I'm a big fan of your dad. And that list of movies came to my mind because I ran it in my mind so much. I said, a big fan of your dad. And he was like shy, but boy, did he perk up. I said, the Ten Commandments, he was in Around the World 80 Days, Bride of Frankenstein, Grapes of Wrath, Stagecoach, The Shootist, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, Blood and Sand. And he says, oh, Blood and Sand. David said, yeah, my dad, he did the death scene. That's the best. So, and better than going back in a time machine to tell Fred, you know, you're full of it. Here's the list of Carradine's great movies. I was able to do that list to Carradine's son. So sometimes you get nice little payoffs like that. And at the time, I didn't think at Omega Cop 2, Ron Marchini, the producer and star, didn't ask me to direct Omega Cop 2 because he could get David Carradine in one scene, cameo of his Omega Cop 2, if he hired David Carradine's friend to direct. So I actually lost Omega Cop 2. But see, that's fair. I wasn't bugged because, to get David Carradine, that was great. But I didn't even think of it at the time. Here's Carradine who cut me out of Omega Cop 2. So all kinds of fun things connect if you keep your memory and, if you have a, remember things and have a, connecting sense of humor about it. So that's I love that story. What better than to, instead of telling Fred the list of Carradine movies, tell John Carradine's son. So that was a real payoff for me.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Paul, it's been a real pleasure. I learned a lot tonight, but, thanks again for coming on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's always great talking with you and being connected on Facebook. And you gave me a great help on editing that Woody Strode article I did and gave me some good ideas and retitling it. And you tested the article and got some feedback and you helped me with it. Really appreciate. So it's great to be connected. With this internet, all us artists can connect and help each other. It's wonderful.
That's amazing. That's great. Well, man, I wish you much success with all your projects.
Okay. Thank you, William. Great talking to you.
All right. God bless. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye. And let me leave you with this quote from Jude Law. My only obligation is to keep myself and other people guessing. Good night.